Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. Okay, it's the end of a long year. And if you're anything like me, you're probably feeling exhausted. Like the kind of sugar-drenched, post-holiday, limbs melting into the couch upholstery kind of tired. Which means it is the perfect time to curl up with a blanket and a warm drink and listen to a story. And luckily for you, we have just the one, an old favorite from the Side Door Vault. This story begins at an auction for toys. Bess, what is it like to go to a toy auction?
Well, there are a lot of old ladies, usually.
I fit right in.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, I was 7 or 8 when I was going to these auctions.
This is author Bess Winter.
They were specifically doll auctions. I think your eyes would water at the amount of money that is spent. There are certain American dolls that are like American folk art, and those go for like $10,000-$15,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's a lot for a doll.
It is a lot for a doll. It basically is an investment piece, like buying a piece of art.
As a kid, Bess didn't go to auctions to diversify her art portfolio. She was there because her mom was an antiques collector. And when you're a kid, you pretty much go where your parents go. Bess learned to recognize valuable dolls, but she didn't have much money.
So I knew what kind of doll was valuable and appealing, but I couldn't afford the actual good versions of those. So it would be like, oh, this one's been squished into a box for 50 years and its head's kind of square, but it's still a Lency.
Bess took her oddly shaped antique dolls home and made up stories to bring them to life.
Yeah, I grew up as an only child, so I did a lot of solitary imaginative play. And I played with all kinds of things, but I was attracted to dolls, I think, because they were a bit like puppets or characters that I could make stories about.
These days, Bess writes her stories down. Mostly she writes about people, but sometimes she writes about dolls too. And today, Bess Winter will read one of her fictional stories about a real doll that, you guessed it, lives at the Smithsonian. So this time on Side Door, we time travel with Bess to the late 1800s to meet a talking doll invented by Thomas Edison. This doll has an angelic face, but hides a demonic secret.
Side Door is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So here's Bess Winter's story of a holiday gift like no other. A talking doll invented by Thomas Edison. And just for clarity, this doll is real, but the story is fiction. So here it is, an excerpt from Bess's story titled Talking Dolls.
The doll. Too heavy to be tucked into the branches of the Christmas tree, she rested beneath its shaggy limbs. In her eyes, a reflection of the fairy lights dangling from branches above, the flames that spat inside their glass bellies, and of the family that gathered now around the tree. Mother, in new garnet earrings. Straight-backed father, straighter than the back of his oak chair. Grandmother Rose, pinching a cross-stitched bookmark, a gift from her granddaughters, who had shared in the stitching, though you couldn't tell their stitches apart, between her yellowed fingernails. They watched in silence as the sisters lifted the long-anticipated doll away from her resting place, her inner machinery heavy enough that both sisters had to clutch her. Her eyes were sleeping eyes, lashes that batted her china cheeks. Her chest talked in a curious way when she was hoisted. Dangling at her wrist, a tag, Thomas Edison's famous talking doll. And here were the sisters in matching new-made pinafores, white lace for Christmas, knotted snug at their backs by their rough-handed nurse. Their tumbling pigtails and rumpled stockings. These sisters were at precisely that point when a little girl is an even more perfect shape and size than her doll. And each was a copy of the other. A single birthmark twinned their upper lips. A sideward glance seemed to skate across the face of one sister and onto the face of the other. Now they held the doll between them and searched for the crank. When they found it, both took hold. Here was the noise, shrieking metal, the spirit of an angry child scrabbled up from the grave. Mother recoiled. Father furrowed his brow. Grandmother Rose waved a knotty hand before her face as if she might shoo the child banshee away. And the twins, to their relative's surprise, swatted each other's hands. You turned it too quickly. No, you snatched at it. I didn't. Reluctant mother calling for nurse. Nurse still chewing breakfast, hurrying from somewhere deep within the house to separate the girls, to place the doll in the hands of one and then the other. As each took her turn with the crank, the other glared at her sister, willing the demon voice to return. And it did. Neither girl could call up a girl voice from the toy. One sister sat on the rug, dumb as a doll, and cried, while the other pressed her fists into her own eye sockets to make colors bloom behind her lids. All this observed by the grown relatives who clutched the arms of their chairs. Now the doll was passed among the grown-ups. First, nurse, who cooed that Dolly only needed some care and patience. She cranked with three ruddy fingers pinched around the handle, pinky raised like to whisper, "Careful, careful." The girls gathered close, watching. One hung her head on nurse's shoulder. One leaned eager on the heels of her hands. And still the shriek. Nurse's face, a brief twist into some adult disappointment, a look that betrayed her life beyond the nursery, the house, that suggested she'd seen a thing or two she didn't like before. Give it to Mother. Here was Mother's hand, outstretched and shivering, that seldom lifted anything heavier than a handkerchief. Nurse hoisted the doll into Mother's dipping arm, and Mother quick lurched forward to catch the heavy toy, lifting it roughly in a way the girls had never seen. She sat the doll on her lap where the sisters had never sat. With one finger, she brushed back its bouncy curls. Such alien tenderness her daughters watched in silence. The translucence of her fingernail just as it caught the light. The doll's curls snagging like ribbon. Even this, the look she wore, a young girl's look, a curious tangle like one who would give everything to be a girl again, to sit on the rug with her own doll. She turned the crank, the demon call. And Mother's fallen face, the small slump that registered only in the loosening of the crepe about her shoulder blades, the way her grip sagged around the doll's waist, the toy tilting in her lap. A tremendous failure. Mother, she said, her gaze fixed somewhere on the rug. Would you like to try the doll? Keep it away, said Grandmother Rose. It's broken, kitty. Here was Father, her husband. Broken machinery. He reached for it. The doll in Father's serious hands, another vision for his daughters. Father touched pens and inkwells. Father touched long guns and dead ducks with floppy necks and the flag that wagged on the pole in the yard that he alone raised and lowered daily. Had Father ever touched a doll before? The action of his fingers as he reset the needle. The fold of his brow above his troubled eyes. Maybe the final gesture ever shared between these sisters. A look, a a weird bob in the chest that said, "Isn't it strange to see Father puzzling over this poor frilly creature?" To see him sheepishly pull aside the dress where it's slit and clutch the cool tin body in his reluctant hands, the doll's audacious yellow curls drooping onto his knees. Father scrutinizing the doll, staring into the china face, the glass eyes, the sleeping lids that were slow to open to him. "Defective," he said to the doll. One sister hoisting herself off the rug, going to stand by Father. The other preoccupied now by her own new coral bracelet, a gift from Grandmother Rose that she turned around and around on her small brown wrist. "She'll have to go back," said Father. "Oh." Here was the twin who stood by Father. Now a deep sadness set in, sympathy for this doll who must be shut up in a box, banished from this parlor, this family, this city, and lugged by careless postmen back to the terrible lonely place she was made, where she'd maybe be destroyed. The sister pictured a man with a hammer smashing her china face to powder. "But she's still nice, isn't she? Look at her dress," she tried. "It's very fine. We'll buy you a fine dress like hers. No use keeping a broken doll just for her dress." "I've sewn nicer dresses than that for your old dollies," said Grandmother Rose. "Oh, stop now with the crying, young lady. How spoiled you are. Look how nicely your sister sits." Sister on the rug, still turning the bracelet round her wrist. In this sister, a sweet hot thing that kicked up now, and kicked harder as Father explained how wronged she'd been, how wronged all of them had been, how expensive this item and how difficult to acquire, what a sham they'd fallen for, what an unconscionable scoundrel Thomas Edison, who cared only about profits and not about little girls. "He hates little girls, is what it is," said Father. The sharp-edged word "hate" twirled in her mind, a keen little gemstone. Did she hate? Who could she hate? Thomas Edison, yes, all the Edison people who'd ruined her present. She saw them, Hecates, twisting and battering the insides of the doll before tossing them in like rubbish. Or maybe they'd sabotaged only one small part, a tooth on a gear bent by an intentional finger while they'd laughed. She hated them. She had more hate. She swirled her gaze around the room, everyone caught in it. Mother, lips pursed and hand rested on Father's fist. Grandmother Rose stroking the tassel that hung from her new bookmark. Nurse and the knot of brown bread still in her hand from breakfast. Her sister, watery-eyed, pleading with Father. Father and his stiff grasp on the doll. The doll. She leveled her hate onto it. The doll took her hate, pulled it into her joints and her useless tin body and her sweet, dumb face. The doll took so much hate, she was surprised it didn't crack apart. Father handed it to Nurse, who would carry it, soaked with hate, and pack it back into its box and return it, full of hate, to the horrible place it had come from.
That's Bess Winter reading from her short story collection titled Machines of Another Era.
Bess, I love this story.
Thank you.
And I have to ask, have you ever been so bitterly disappointed in a gift as a child that it caused you to hate the inventor of the gift?
No, I don't think I made connections so clearly between toys and their inventors when I was a child, but I have had, like all of us, incredibly disappointing gifts that either arrived broken. I remember specifically there used to be a toy that was, you draw on it, it looks kind of like an Etch-a-Sketch, and then you're supposed to be able to print out the drawing that you have made. And that thing didn't work at all, and actually I didn't get mad at the inventor, but I did get mad at Santa because I thought, this is faulty. And why did you make me up? I thought Santa made it there, you know.
Yeah, and, well, that's there's the inventor.
Yeah. Santa was the inventor. And my mom had to reassure me that she was going to send it back to Santa's workshop to see if they could fix it. And they never could, because that toy was a complete piece of junk. So I never saw it again.
How much research do you do for a story like this that's based on something in history but is fictional?
That's a good question. I usually research until, A, my curiosity is satisfied and I feel like I can weave a plausible fiction out of this, and B, I've done justice to the subject, even if it's not completely true. I'll use this story as an example. It really started with the doll as object, and I see writing sort of as play. So also when I'm teaching, because I teach creative writing to undergraduate students, the whole point of that is to get students back to their childhood state of wonder. That's what I always tell them at the beginning of a semester is, okay, we're going to try to knock all of the barnacles off of you, all of the films that you've seen and the screens that you've looked at and the ways you think you need to talk and look and see things, all of that's going to be wiped away so that you can go back to where you were when you were a kid and you were looking at the world.
Coming up after a quick break, we find out what was up with Thomas Edison's talking dolls. Stick around. So when I first read Bess Winter's story, I could not believe that Thomas Edison, inventor of the phonograph, early motion pictures, and the first mass-produced light bulb, would intentionally have created a demonic talking doll. But he did. Naturally, I had some questions. So I called up National Museum of American History curator Carlene Stevens.
I'm responsible for the phonograph collections and the sound recordings before electricity got applied to them.
And after hearing Bess Winter's story, I was dying to see some of these dolls. But since the museum is temporarily closed at the moment, I cannot go see it myself. So can you sort of describe the doll to us?
Well, this is a doll that's about 2 feet tall, and it came with various faces. The torso was common to all the dolls. It was a tin box perforated by holes, and inside the tin box was a very peculiar rendition of Edison's phonograph.
That's right. Inside the doll was a phonograph, an early record player, also invented by Edison.
The phonograph played a wax record that was 3 inches in diameter. And then a needle, a stylus, would travel in the grooves to produce the sound that emanated from the holes in the metal torso. The doll's head was a gorgeous porcelain affair. The museum's example has no hair. So when you look at the back of the head, there's a great big open space where that hair would have been attached. Yeah. So
what happened to its hair?
We don't know.
Developing the doll with a tiny phonograph inside was Edison's way of trying to solve a problem. Suspend everything you know about the last century of the music industry and try to put yourself in Edison's shoes. He'd invented this machine that recorded and played back human voices, but he had no idea what it was for, how to sell it to the public. So the doll was one idea for applying the phonograph's technology. But if you remember that recording you heard in the story, unfortunately for Edison, that voice is how the doll actually sounded. And in case you didn't get enough, here it is one more time.
The sound that this doll makes is pretty screechy. The voices on these recordings are basically those of teenage girls from 1889 screaming into the Edison phonograph doing the recording. So,
oh my gosh.
Every single one of these records had to be done one at a time. There was no mass production. If I was screeching into this machine, I got one record out of it, not 10 copies. So the sound that comes from this record is over 100 years old. It's done by a shrieking teenager. The fidelity wasn't good in the first place because it was a needle scratching sound into wax.
When it's explained this way, it's no wonder these recordings sound the way that they do. But despite the crude audio quality, Edison's dolls were celebrated. In 1890, they were featured on the cover of Scientific American magazine. People were excited.
People who could afford to buy this doll really wanted one because it had the latest technology in a gorgeous product. They were expensive. $10 for an undressed doll. $12 to $20 if it was dressed. That was in April of 1890. And $10 in 1890 is about $260, $270 today. So you had to be a fairly well-off early adopter to get this doll.
So people were shelling out big money for this doll. 10 bucks, an entire Sheridan. That's who was on the $10 bill in 1890. People had high expectations. And why not?
On the outside, they were gorgeous dolls. On the inside, they had cutting-edge technology.
But like so many hyped-up toys,
they were disappointing to the people of the period when they didn't perform as expected. And the sound wasn't something that people wanted to hear over and over and over and over again.
It's easy to imagine the parents of the day gathering up these misfit dolls and, like Bess's mother, sending them back to Santa. Or in this case, to Thomas Edison.
It didn't sell well at all. There were great delays in getting it to market, and a lot of them were returned, and he started trying to make an improved version but couldn't raise enough money and then just dropped it.
Edison's talking dolls were no more.
To be fair, it wasn't clear at that time that recorded sound played back was going to become the basis of an enormous music industry. I think there's a lesson in that about invention and what it takes to have an idea come to a successful market situation and get absorbed by American culture. It's not instantaneous. And the doll is one of these incredibly interesting sidetrackings. I was trying to say something about side door and side story, but it didn't work. It didn't work. Sorry.
I've given up on trying to make side door puns because they get universally rejected. Maybe it's a cul-de-sac on the road of invention.
Yeah, it is. It's a cul-de-sac on the road to invention.
But maybe this road, peppered with cul-de-sacs, is really one big roundabout. Because the problem with Edison's scorn-worthy demon dolls wasn't the idea. It just took us more than a century to follow through on his vision. And if you want proof of Edison's concept, look no further than side door producer Justin O'Neill's living room, where a little girl plays with her own talking doll. And this one isn't a demon, but it is a monster. You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX.
If you want to read more of Bess Winter's stories, the name of her book, again, was Machines of Another Era. Special thanks this episode to Bess Winter, Carlene Stevens, Peter Liebhold, and Valeska Hilbig. Giggles this episode were provided by Ada O'Neill. You can catch a glimpse of the Smithsonian's hairless, talking Edison doll and hear more creepy recordings by signing up for our newsletter at si.edu/sidedoor. This episode was produced by Justin O'Neill, Natalie Boyd, Sharon Bryant, Ann Cannon, Caitlin Schaefer, Jess Sadek, Tammy O'Neill, and Lara Koch. Extra support comes from Jason and Genevieve at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. As we wrap up the year, we're asking for your help to make more Smithsonian stories possible. So if you enjoy Sidedoor in your podcast feed, consider making a tax-deductible donation now during our critical year-end fundraising drive. You can give whatever's appropriate for your budget. It's super fast, easy, and secure. To give now, please visit si.edu/contribute. Thank you so much for joining us and listening to the show in 2021. The enthusiasm and support of listeners like you helps bring every story we tell on Sidedoor to life, like a demon doll, but way better. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening. This doll has an angelic face, but hides a demonic secret. What do you mean? It's gold. I'm handing you gold. From PRX.